This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in, and join us on Twitter at KUOW. You don't like to wait around, right? You use the automated checkout at your grocery store. You don't need a clerk. You just swipe the milk, swipe the aspirin, and the Fig Newtons have a crinkly container on it. I'm having trouble getting the scan on the Fig Newton. There it is. Okay. But anyway, it's pretty quick, though. You know, you just go on your way. Well, today Amazon took this idea further. They opened a store in Seattle's Belltown neighborhood where you walk in, swipe your phone, pick up your groceries, and walk out. No checkout lines, no individual scanning items, almost no employees there, just sensors and cameras. So now we're going to find out, what is that convenience? And what's it going to cost you? So we have two guests. First, from the tech news site, GeekWire, Todd Bishop, who got a demo last week and bought some Odwalla. Hiya, Todd.
Hi, Bill.
And you went again this morning.
I did.
Okay. I want to know, how do they know that was you leaving the store with your Odwalla?
When you walk into the Amazon Go store, you have the app installed on your phone, and it has a QR code unique to you. And from that point, there are cameras overhead, color cameras and depth sensors, which combine with weight sensors in the shelves to track you through the store and to follow your interactions with the shelves. So
they know what you picked up because the cameras are watching you move around and pick things up? That's it?
Exactly. And you do nothing beyond that point except pick something off the shelf. If you put it back, they know you put it back. I tried this morning with two different types of salads. I grabbed one type of salad and then, you know, held it, you know, close to me and then put it back and then grabbed the other one right on top of it. And I walked out. And moments later, it's actually this morning, it was a few minutes later, they send a receipt to the app and they knew which salad I had actually taken out. It tracked it precisely.
And again, it's not about scanning you as you walk out. There's Todd and this is what's in his basket or his arm or anything like that. It's watching you pick up things and put them back or not.
Yes, that's exactly. But then it treats the person in the store, as an Amazon executive told me last week, as an entity. You are an entity moving through the store. And so they know that you've first picked up the item off the shelf and then they know that you've exited.
Right.
And at that point, they can debit your account.
Got it. And how convenient was that?
Super convenient. I walked in and out last week in the test, picked up an Odwalla, and I was out in 23 seconds. And I don't care how fast your 7-Eleven clerk is, the chances of you being able to charge something like that to your account and get in and out of the store in 23 seconds is pretty much impossible.
Okay, Todd says convenient. Now we're going to talk about what is that convenience going to cost you. First of all, Todd, any thoughts on that? Did you feel any downside?
Well, I felt almost like I would feel when I was browsing an online web page and knowing that somebody was tracking my every click, my every hover of the mouse over a link. And, you know, it did make me feel very much like it was a physical retail experience created by someone who specialized in e-commerce, which is exactly what it is.
Now let's bring in a privacy expert, University of Washington law professor Ryan Kahlo. Good to see you, Ryan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
What do you think? What does you haven't shopped at this Amazon Go store, I take it?
Not yet. Nope.
Okay. What do you think from Todd's description, what will all that convenience cost us?
Well, let me first say that actually it's not obvious that it's all bad for privacy.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so, you know, one way it could be good for privacy is that you don't feel like you have to confront somebody when you buy something sensitive. Right. You don't feel like you have to, you know, check out those condoms or whatever it is that you're trying to get. Right. And so there might be a sense in which people experience it as privacy liberating. Right. But, you know, as Todd points out, they really, truly are trying to recreate in a real world environment the kind of exquisite granular detail that they get online. And that's one thing that concerns me, frankly. And it concerns me precisely because I worry that they're going to use that data in ways that ultimately disadvantage the consumer.
I want to talk about this. First of all, my reaction is my local QFC knows what I buy. My credit card company knows what I buy. Lots of stores have surveillance cameras. So explain, what is the extra information that Amazon would be getting on us?
Well, look, I mean, it's true that that, you know, Safeway knows, you know, eventually if you have a loyalty card, like what you bought, right? But what they don't know is that you almost bought the Lucky Charms. Like you reached for it, you weren't really certain. They don't know the expression on your face of excitement that you when you first saw that they were carrying a product that you hadn't seen in a while, right? And so there's really a kind of a detail of information that's not available. But in addition,
well, what's wrong with that? So they know what I almost what made my eyebrows go up. So what?
Sure. So in a online environment, not only do companies have a ton of information about individual consumers, but they also control and structure every aspect of that interaction. And I'll take a pretty simple example, which is price. Okay, things cost $9.99. Because it feels to us like further away from $10 than it is, right?
Yeah.
And so, but imagine that Amazon could charge you exactly the most you'd be willing to pay for a product. And so the fact that you are elated about the new shipment of Theo's chocolates might mean that you might actually experience a higher price. Now, is that being done today in Amazon Go stores? I'd be shocked if it were.
But Todd, what do you think? Is that
no?
Amazon charging me the same thing it charges everybody else?
Yeah, absolutely. So the prices are consistent throughout
so far.
However, on the website, right, there was a kerfuffle a few years ago where Amazon was charging people different amounts based on what they figured out about how likely you were to be a repeat customer. And so my concern about taking that incredible granularity and that mediation and introducing it into the real world is that there are many more opportunities to maximize the profit of Amazon or whoever's doing it. The other thing I would worry about is frankly, cybersecurity. And when I talk to experts in cybersecurity at the University of Washington and elsewhere, they raise some concerns as well. So those are the two big things. Is this all going to be good for consumers where they know so much about us? And also, what are the security ramifications?
Okay, well, I'm not done talking about the idea of me paying more than somebody else, which could create winners and losers, I would think. So if Amazon thinks that I don't have much money, maybe, you know, based on what I buy, maybe they don't charge me as much. Or they can tell, man, Radke really likes Fig Newtons. He'd probably pay more than the average person for Fig Newtons. Well, they're right. I would. So I start with Todd. What's the problem with that?
I think to take this even a step further, what Ryan's talking about when you're applying online principles to physical retail, Amazon has this immense power because it has all of this data online. And one of the things that online retailers do in particular very well is what's called retargeting, where you are indicating a preference for something, and then they hit you with ads that test the edges of that preference and say, okay, you lingered. And you could see this happening in the retail store where you linger over a product and you pick it off the shelf and you put it back, and then you go on to Amazon.com, and then they're hitting you with an ad. And I think, and to be clear, I asked about this. Amazon is not doing this right now with the data from Amazon Go, but the store demonstrates that potential. The technology is there. They have the power.
Yeah.
And it's just a question of whether they would want to test the limits of personal privacy in that way.
So, Ryan, we're not used to Amazon or some corporation knowing that I lingered or I pick it up, I put it back, or I looked excited. So it feels weird, but that is information they can use or not use when they send me an ad, and I can respond to that ad by buying or not buying. So what am I giving up in that situation?
Well, I mean, my concern in this area, right, and the concern of consumer protection law in general is about asymmetry of information and of power, right? It's not just that, of course, they can observe something and so could I guess, and I can make changes to my behavior and choices. But at the end of the day, they have so much information, not just about me, but about everybody else. And they have this power to really construct my experience. And the concern of consumer protection law is the idea that they would abuse it. Now, I'll give you another example that doesn't involve paying too much, because you're right. There are winners and losers when you do price discrimination. And that's actually a feature of it, not a bug. But imagine that you're trying to cut something out of your diet. And Amazon has noticed that, you know, you often will buy these chocolates or you'll buy this thing of brandy or whatever when you shop for things. And they notice that this particular time you haven't done it. And you're real close. Like you really, it's been quite a lot of willpower you spent not buying that chocolate.
Yeah.
And you're on your way out and all of a sudden you get a ping on your phone that says, hey, did you forget the chocolate, right? Just in the same way as Microsoft says, I see that you mentioned an attachment in your email, but did you want to attach something? And that is, I think that is not just possible. I think it's highly plausible and highly likely that as we go forward. And so, you know, these things are not always bad for consumers, and I've never claimed that, but they're not always good. And I think that convenience is only part of the picture.
Right. I can be weak. I can be irrational. Companies already play on that. And you're just talking about companies getting more and more power and the ability to exploit those possibilities for themselves.
Exactly.
On Facebook, Jennifer writes, between Amazon Fresh, Prime Now, and Instacart, I hardly find it necessary to go to the groceries, but I'll probably check it out anyhow. Is this the future of shopping, do you think? Is this going to overwhelm the way we shop now, Todd?
I think it's possible. This, to me, is a test, and it's a test for Amazon. It's also a test for the retail industry. Will there be enough demand and enough comfort with the application of, you know, basically online principles to our physical lives for it to catch on? I will say we've got a reporter down there right now, literally right now in downtown Seattle. The line is around the block for Amazon Go. And certainly that's a function of it being a novelty and the fact that it's lunchtime in downtown Seattle. But I think there's an indication here at least that people are willing to sacrifice a little bit of that physical privacy to have that convenience.
Yes. Oh, and by the way, very few employees are in this store. There are people stocking and maybe some people making some food items, but it's fewer and fewer people. So are we going to be seeing unemployment lines around the block because of shopping like this? They're vaporizing millions of retail jobs.
If you compare it to a traditional convenience store like a 7-Eleven, there are actually more employees. It's about 1,800 square feet, this store, and they've got people working and making food in the back. They've also got somebody at the entrance, somebody checking ID at the beer and wine section, and also some employees on the floor. So they are eliminating the cashiers, but at least in Amazon's example, they are replacing that with other employees. Now, if you, though, extend that to the scale of a large grocery store, you can start to see where it does have a significant impact on jobs.
Yeah, Amazon just bought Whole Foods. Yeah. Are they going to fire the cashiers?
So I asked about that. Amazon said they do not currently plan to roll this out to Whole Foods. And that's clearly a very sensitive topic, especially in the grocery industry, which is heavily unionized.
Also on Facebook, Avril writes, perfectly illustrates the ever-growing class divide. And I get that this seems fancy and elitist and techie, but is it really does this represent a class divide, the Amazon Go low employee, no checkout line store?
Well, so one of the things that I study as a part of studying artificial intelligence policy is indeed the impact on jobs. And you worry about the fact that the kinds of jobs that are going to be displaced, especially in the short run, are jobs of people that are not necessarily making a ton of money, and they're not always in a position where they can be easily retrained to do something else. And so I find compelling the arguments that say that innovations like this will lead, if anything, to more jobs because it'll expand the economy and there'll be new categories of jobs we haven't dreamt up yet. But the people that are going to be displaced in the interim are often the most vulnerable. And you see that, for example, with the trucking industry. I mean, a very plausible place where automation is going to do a massive disruption is trucking. And folks who are truckers are, you know, obviously there are many smart and interesting people among them, but they don't necessarily are not necessarily well positioned to transition easily to something else. And that's, I worry about the unevenness of the application more than I do that all the jobs are going to go away.
Right. Good point. That's the University of Washington law professor and privacy expert Ryan Kahlo. And we also have Todd Bishop here from the tech news site GeekWire. We've been talking about this new Amazon Go grocery and convenience store that opened up today at 7th and Blanchard in Belltown. Any final thoughts on my opening question, which is, what's the convenience? What's it going to cost you? Final thoughts on Amazon Go, Todd?
If I had a choice of popping into an Amazon Go and versus waiting in line for the 7-Eleven clerk to serve everybody hot dogs out of the hot case.
As good as those are.
As good as they are, it can often take a long time. And this is very convenient. And if the privacy is the price to be paid, I think there clearly are a lot of people who are willing to pay it.
Yeah, lying around the block, said Todd Bishop, who visited it today. Any final thoughts, Ryan Kahlo?
just that Amazon really should do this thoughtfully and right. I mean, if this is going to take off, they need to be mindful of the privacy and security ramifications and not take advantage of consumers, in which case it could be a net really good.
Amazon Go store opening today in Seattle, and we've been talking about it with Todd Bishop and from University of Washington, Ryan Kahlo. And from you, too, thanks for your comments on Facebook, and keep listening to KUOW. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. It looks like the government shutdown will end soon, at least for now. Senate Democrats relented today and went along with a bill that reopens federal agencies for 2.5 weeks. But then what? What happens to undocumented immigrants who were brought here as children? And what about that border wall? Let's welcome NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi there.
What did Democrats agree to?
What they have agreed to is this short-term funding bill that runs through February 8th, along with the promise that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would allow them to bring up essentially a clean immigration bill that would be fair to both sides. They would open up the amendment process, and that then they could address this DACA situation with the hundreds of thousands of undocumented people, children, people that were brought here as children. And so those are the concessions that they extracted. This bill also extends the popular CHIP program for low-income children, the insurance program. So that is one thing that Republicans had put in there to sweeten the deal. So this is sort of another temporary thing. And the big thing hanging over it is this immigration bill and whether they can reach some sort of consensus in the next, few weeks.
Yes. To remind our listeners, President Trump said he's ending the executive protections that President Obama gave these childhood arrivals, the so-called Dreamers, and said it's up to Congress to protect them with a law. So now you say that the Democrats got the concession of that they're going to be able to bring up an immigration bill. But what are the odds Congress would pass what Democrats want, the DACA protection?
I mean, that's the really big question of whether what you have a bipartisan group of senators that approached this president last week, and exactly what the president would sign. In the White House briefing just a few minutes ago, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was pressed on whether that would include a pathway to citizenship for these Dreamers. She would not commit to that, whether it could be citizenship or just legal status. A lot of people want to see full citizenship for these, but then you have a more conservative wing in the Senate, people like Tom Cotton from Arkansas, that do not want that. And so you've had the president certainly pulled in a lot of different directions when he had that meeting the week before last, where he had a lot of people there in the White House discussing it. He seemed to sort of be swayed by whoever spoke to him last. You had Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer that said that when he went to the White House on Friday, right as the government shutdown was impending, that he even put the border wall on the table for the president. And he seemed to agree to this for a deal for the Dreamers. But then, again, he's swayed by a lot of even the hardliners that are in his administration, including his chief of staff, John Kelly, and White House aide Stephen Miller. So I think the president is a really big question mark about what he would support here.
The Senate Majority Leader, Republican Mitch McConnell, said that Democrats caved because they realized holding out for a DACA deal, again, this is the childhood arrivals, holding out for a DACA deal was not wise politically. What does he mean by that?
I think that they had framed this as that they were sort of holding the government hostage over this. The government shutdown, if it ends today, which we are expecting it to do, they have to still go through some procedural measures. The House still has to approve it. They have to vote on it again. The president has to sign it. But we are expecting everything to be resolved at the end of the day. Had this drug on, you have federal workers that aren't getting paid, services interrupted. If you remember, we had the last one in 2013 that drug on for 16 days, and Republicans suffered. They ended up winning in 2014, but there were a lot of other situations in that. And I think that if they had made this, I think Republicans were beginning to make this argument that this is sort of what they're sort of holding out that they want for this, when you could see Republicans arguing this is just a spending bill, this is what we want. And I think, but again, the more liberal base of the Democratic wing really are upset that they caved in a way. You had a lot of the more liberal members, including a lot of people that are looking toward possibly running in 2020, like Kamala Harris in California, Cory Booker in New Jersey, Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, that voted no. And a lot of the statements that I've gotten from progressive groups, they're actually pretty upset that the Democrats did not hold the line on this.
Well, what makes... You're not Mitch McConnell's brain, but what when he says that a DACA deal, he doesn't think it's wise politically for the Democrats. Why does he say that? I mean, maybe the Republicans would be blamed for the shutdown. What's the political cost that he seemed to think Democrats would pay for this government shutdown?
I think that, again, as it just went on, I think that they thought that the optics of it would end up being bad if they were just holding out for this. But the argument that Democrats made was this was a unified Republican government and they were unable to reach a deal that would include this. And, you know, the polling was a little bit hard to read because it was, you know, pretty in the moment. We saw polling late last week that actually Republicans would get more of the blame, but also that a majority of Americans did not want the government to shut down over DACA specifically. So I think they're looking at maybe that number and saying, okay, the tide could turn in our favor on this issue.
You mentioned that this is only a temporary spending measure, and you mentioned the children's health insurance program. So the fact that it's only a 2.5-week measure, what does that mean for this CHIP, children's health insurance program? It's only funded temporarily?
No, they are actually extending that for 6 years.
Okay.
So that is being fully funded.
Okay. And what about the border wall? Is it clear yet what's going to happen with the president's request for money for a wall that apparently Mexico won't pay for?
It is not really. Again, you had Schumer that says that he put this on the table for the president for funding, which is, of course, one of the big things he wanted. But you have a lot of Democrats that don't want that because of they think that, you know, maybe a series of, you know, different enforcement measures along the border could be better in a way. But it's not just the wall that we could see the president holding out on. He really wants an end to what he calls chain migration, which is bringing over family members of these dreamers or other people. And then also an end to the visa lottery system and stuff, too. So there's a lot of things that are going to go into this bill that the parties are still really far apart on. And again, we don't have a very clear sense of what the president is willing to compromise on and what he's not.
NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor telling us about the coming end of the government shutdown. What are the odds we're going to be here again on February 8th? This is only a 2.5-week stopgap spending measure.
Right. I would say with the way that we have seen these things go, it really could go down to the wire again. This is a Congress that seems to pass these CRs repeatedly and
that's
kind
a continuing
of run down
resolution.
To the wire. Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the way that we've seen just stalemates on the Hill, it could really feel like Groundhog Day, and I fear in a few weeks, certainly.
Finally, Jessica, was anything learned in this process? We've had government shutdowns before. They're each different. This one with the new president and all the issues we've just discussed. Was anything learned from this?
I think that what we saw is just that Washington remains dysfunctional, that even when you have a unified government, and that's one of the things that Democrats will really push forward going into the midterms is saying, you know, Republicans are in control. Can they govern? Can they get this passed? And I don't think it's going to be lost on some people that this happened on the 1-year anniversary of Trump's inauguration as well. So that's something that runs that could certainly hurt them down the line. But then, you know, as we talked about earlier, too, Democrats are really pulled in different directions on this, too. Some think that they caved. Some wanted them to stay to the base. So it's not the Democratic Party isn't fully united on a way forward either.
NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor, thanks a lot for this.
Thank you.
Following today's news on the coming end of the government shutdown, President Trump has weighed in, saying he's pleased that congressional Democrats have come to their senses and abandoned the filibuster. Trump says the administration will make a long-term immigration deal, quote, if and only if it's good for our country. So it's a big mystery as to what that is going to mean for this president and for this Congress. The president issued his statement today after about 25 senators from both parties helped negotiate an end to the federal government shutdown. Now the formalities remain. The House has got to approve what the Senate passes, et cetera. President's got to sign it. We'll follow it on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Over the weekend, the Washington State University community gathered in front of Martin Stadium in Pullman to remember Tyler Helinski.
He's really a great role model on campus. He's really somebody to look up to.
He was such a humble person, a kind person. Any interaction was always so positive.
He was such a good representation of Wazoo that I think that's why it's impacted us, because he was such a good human.
The 21-year-old quarterback was found dead in his apartment last week, an apparent suicide. After the news came out about Helinski's death, Seattle Times sports columnist Matt Calkins wrote about his own struggles with depression and suicidal thoughts. Calkins wants people to be more open about what they're going through. He told me he first started to feel anxiety and depression when he was a teenager.
I remember I'd go on like high school debate trips and I wouldn't say a word for like 3 days until I was actually debating. I was fine. Same thing when I did play-by-play radio. I'd get on the mic and be, you know, highly entertaining according to people who would listen, but then I'd get on the bus later and I would just completely shut down. And sometimes that would lead to depression. And, you know, sometimes if I maybe didn't feel like I was keeping up with my peer group or whatnot, I would really get into my own head and I just couldn't shake it. So I'd say in one form or another, this has been affecting me for a good 20 years or so.
To the point where you, as you write, you actually considered taking your life as well.
Yeah, there were times later in my life where I was, you know, maybe just because I didn't feel like where I wanted to be in life, or maybe I was just, I'd get out of these social situations and I would just be so flustered and I go, how do I fix this? And, you know, there'd be times where I'm turning to alcohol, you know, to kind of soothe that discomfort. But there'd be times where I was going on to Google and like looking up like the most effective way to take your own life. Like, oh, a shotgun is the easiest way. This carries the most risks and all that stuff, which is kind of horrifying when I look back on it. But I also know that it's a lot more common than people would think. I use the word fantasizing about suicide because it is a coping device for a lot of people. They think about it. How do I get out of this? Okay, well, I can always take my own life. Not a healthy way to think about it, but that's why they do it.
It's comforting in a way because it's an exit lane.
Yeah.
Yeah. You first wrote about your own depression, suicidal thoughts, mm-hmm. when that Hall of Famer linebacker, mm-hmm. Junior Seau, took his life in 2012. That's a big step. Mm-hmm. What was the reaction from people who had no idea what you were going
right.
through?
So that one was a lot more difficult for me to write. That one, I called my mom and dad beforehand and said, hey, listen, this is what I'm writing. I called my sister, some friends, and said, hey, this is what I'm writing. I emailed some really close friends, say, hey, what do you think about this? I was really nervous what the reaction would be.
Well, how much did your family know about what you were going through?
They knew that I'd seen counselors before. They knew that I'd been on different medications. They didn't know it got quite as dark as it did. I mean, that in that column, I was looking up different plans. You know, make a rock climbing suicide look like an accident, despair, my family's pain, like as the guy who killed himself. So, I mean, I was really
open. You were thinking it out.
Those were things that I was thinking about constantly. And again, it was like a coping device. I didn't feel good where I was at in life. I couldn't get out of this funk, but I also wasn't trying that hard through the traditional ways of, you know, talking to people. I was just kind of hoping it would go away, and it didn't. But my family was extremely supportive. I mean, they were surprised, but, you know, they were very supportive, and so was the local community. So that gave me a lot more confidence going forward when I had a much bigger platform in the Seattle Times that people would probably be able to relate to this.
I think a lot of us want to know, Matt, what got you to get help? What helped you?
The first time I went to a counselor was my senior year of college. I was at Loyola Marymount, as I mentioned, and I'd gone through a breakup, and I just couldn't quite get over it. That was sort of the fire in the kitchen that got me in there, but I had to remodel the whole house anyway because there were other issues that I was dealing with. And a lot of people find therapy to be cathartic the first time, but I think where it's really effective is when you stick with it and they give you different coping strategies. And sometimes they put you on medication, which I think a lot of people are reluctant to admit they're on, or people have the wrong idea about it, like it mutes your life when it really doesn't. It just kind of gets you to the ground floor. I'm still able to laugh hysterically at, you know, a stand-up comedian or cry at the end of Field of Dreams. I mean, there's nothing that I don't feel that I didn't feel before. Just when the times where it would get out of hand, that's kind of where I've been able to get it under control.
What about a change in attitude? You write, you said something really remarkable, I thought, in your column. You said, my brain hasn't always been good to me.
Yeah.
And most people don't talk about their brains as separate from themselves.
Right.
What did you figure out?
Well, I think that's what's important to talk about here, is to not distinguish a physical illness from a mental illness in terms of how you would treat it or how you would talk about it. You know, I don't think that Prozac should be viewed any differently than amoxicillin. I don't think depression should be viewed any differently than diabetes. These are just problems that we have. And so we got to remove that stigma, because people who are reluctant to get mental health because they're afraid they're going to get judged or because they feel like it's a sign of weakness really shouldn't burden themselves with that. They should be able to get help like they would anything else.
How have you felt that stigma? How have you experienced that?
I've experienced, I think, just in my own head, where I felt like, you know, admitting these things were a sign of weakness. And, you know, there'd be times where I would check off the list, like, are you depressed? Yes. Are you anxious? Yes. Are you feeling suicidal? And I would say no, even though I definitely was, just because I didn't want the doctor to be judging me. I definitely wouldn't bring this stuff up with my parents. I definitely wouldn't bring it up with my friends, because it just kind of, I think the thought in your head is that it's just going to freak them out. Like, I don't want to burden them with this. This is just too dark. Have I received judgment as a result of, you know, admitting mental weakness or being on medication? Not verbally, nothing that I can really tell. So I don't know that I've really felt the stigma on that end, but people
don't. That's interesting, because maybe the stigma isn't any more what we think it is.
Yeah, that's possible. It's possible, and I hope that's the case. But I still know a lot of people are reluctant to talk about this kind of stuff. And maybe even for men a little bit more, just because, you know, they're supposed to be the rocks. And for them to show any kind of weakness might, in their minds, affect how different people judge them. So I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think I am.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, here you are. You're this public job, you know, you're successful, you're writing a column, and in your writing to say, I got help, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't sound like, your column didn't seem like a cry for help.
Right.
I am lost and I don't know what to do, which is a different feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But that's important for us to know. Like, how on it do you think you are? How are you doing today?
I think I'm doing pretty well. It's hard to tell what normal is, right? I don't know how everyone else feels. I know how I felt when I'm feeling really good and, you know, feeling stable and feel like I'm on my right medication. But there are still times where I'll get down on myself, and there are still times where I'll be in social situations and be kind of uncomfortable. And I don't know if that's just natural, or I don't know if that's, you know, some of the symptoms coming back. Here's a good example. I got an email from someone who said, you know, Matt, I read your column and, you know, I used to be suicidal myself, and then I got help, and my quote normal self can't recognize that desperate self that wanted to take my own life. And that's kind of how I feel. That really resonated with me. But there was a time where, you know, I was so depressed and it wouldn't go away. It was 3 months, 4 months, 500 times, and I wasn't getting medication, I wasn't getting therapy, and I never felt like I would get out of it. I never felt like I was going to feel good again. And now I don't feel like I can ever get to that point where I'd want to take my own life, or I don't feel like there's anything to live for. So that just goes to show, I think, how much brain chemistry is part of all this and just getting everything right, because it's strange how our dark selves can't always recognize our more effervescent selves. And so to answer your question, I think I'm pretty on it right now, but it's something that you got to stay on, because you can fool yourself into thinking that you're fine and stop seeing a therapist, stop taking your medication, and you can go down that dark hole again.
I'm talking with Seattle Times sports columnist Matt Calkins. How much is sports a part of this? You wrote about this WSU quarterback who did complete suicide. You're a sports columnist. Mm-hmm. How are depression and suicidal thoughts different for athletes, if they are?
I don't know that they are. These things don't discriminate. Junior Seau was as macho of a guy as you can find, a Hall of Fame linebacker for the Chargers, who had seemingly, you know, the world by a string, and he shot himself in the heart. Michael
this
Phelps.
This is about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, this is about 5 or 6 years ago. You know, we were talking before about Michael Phelps. You know, after every Olympics, he was extremely depressed.
After Olympic domination.
Right, yeah.
4 golds, right. 2 silvers, and he said this weekend.
Right.
Yeah, that he was thinking of committing suicide.
That's wild. It's not wild to me, because I get it. I remember there was a wheelchair racer that I covered when I was at the Vancouver Columbian, and he was born without femurs, and he just dominated and would just dedicate his life to finding every spare millisecond he could find so that he could win. He ended up becoming the most accomplished wheelchair racer in the world. But he said his entire motivation was to make up for the fact that he didn't have femurs, and it didn't matter that it was just that you pour the water into the cup, but the cup never fills up, that kind of thing. And I bet that's true of a lot of athletes who are so dedicated to proving themselves that they're the best, and they're so driven by this that often it leads to, you know, not having the healthiest approach to life mentally.
Yeah, so now we're not just talking about brain chemistry and pharmaceuticals, but an approach to life.
Yeah.
Is there something that you want to tell us about that from your experience?
It's important to know when you're happy. That's kind of one thing I've realized is that I think when we start off and we're younger and maybe we're really motivated, we want to do whatever we can to get to the top, to have the best job or the, you know, the flashiest car and all the toys. And I think, you know, for me, I used to really drive myself crazy needing to write the perfect story. I would never take a word off. Every sentence had to be clever. Every paragraph had to have a perfect transition. It's not to say that I'm not working hard right now. I take my job very seriously. I'm very lucky to have what I have. But yeah, you can really get in your own way doing that. And it's kind of like the Michael Phelps thing. All right, let's say I did write the perfect story and I win an award for it. Okay, that feels good for about a day. And then it's like, okay, what's next? And that's not healthy. That's not what it should be. You should be able to just enjoy. Maybe not even necessarily make happiness the goal every time. Like, how do I make myself happy? Just go about your daily life, do what you want to do, do what you feel you should be doing. And I think that makes it a lot easier. So yeah, it's not just pop a pill and you're better. These are some of the coping strategies and strategies of life that therapists will help you with, is say, all right, just look at it this way. Here's what other people have gone through. Here's what studies suggest. And I think that you become a lot happier and a lot more content as a result.
Matt, what's a reaction you've gotten from your writing that tells you whether you've had an effect?
Oh, I don't know that I can provide enough reactions. I have reactions to spare, I should say. I mean, one was that, hey, listen, I haven't been wanting to go to therapy. I've been reluctant to do it. I'm going to do it now. Or my son doesn't want to admit that anything's wrong with him. He's kind of ashamed of his mental diagnosis. I'm going to show him your article right now to show, hey, look, this is more common than you think. I've gotten 500 emails probably, if not more. And let's, you know, I'll maybe get 5 for a typical Seahawks article. Or if it's really controversial, I might get 50. So it has definitely made an impact. And if it saved one person's life, that's great. And if it makes one person's life better even, then I think it's very rewarding.
Do you think you're part of a big change? Is something going on that maybe we're coming out of a dark age when it comes to how we think about depression and mental health and suicide?
You know, I've heard the argument made that people are less happy now than they were like 30 years ago. And I hope that's not the case, but I've, you know, heard people suggest that. But I do think we're at an age too where we can come out and say, hey, listen, I'm taking this, or hey, I'm going to go see a therapist, or, you know, I've been having these thoughts as well. And people are just more open about it. I think the stigma is declining. I do think that, but I think it's there, and hopefully it vanishes altogether one day.
Well, Matt Calkins, Seattle Times sports writer, I think you're right about the idea of the danger of comparison.
Right.
And when I think of the sports world, I think of how stark is the comparison there. You got this many yards or you didn't. Here's the score. You either won this medal or you didn't.
Yeah, or even salary. People might be making $10 million a year, but if somebody else at their position is making $11 million and they think they're just as good, you know, it'll drive them crazy.
Yeah, but a lot of us who read or will read your column who are not even in the sports world, I think we can all relate to comparison, keeping up with what we're supposed to be,
right,
and trying to get through this life in a balanced way.
Yeah,
it's hard to do.
It is.
I really appreciate you writing the column.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much.
That was Matt Calkins. He's a sports columnist for the Seattle Times, and we are tweeting out a link to the column that he wrote, so join us on Twitter at KUOW. And you know, if you are struggling or somebody you know is having a hard time, depressed, maybe thinking of suicide, there's help. Just for one thing, you could call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and that's 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-8255. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about our last story, the conversation I just had with Seattle Times columnist Matt Calkins on what it takes to prevent suicides like last week's death of Washington State University quarterback Tyler Helinski. Would you email us your thoughts, maybe your stories, your ideas? Our email address is record@kuow.org. Again, record@kuow.org. Well, last week, a couple of internationally known hip-hop dancers performed in Edmonds, Lil Buck and John Boogs. You might know Lil Buck from that viral video of him dancing to the music of cellist Yo-Yo Ma. The piece that Buck and Boogs premiered in Edmonds is called Love Heals All Wounds. It's a dance and spoken word performance about what's going on in the world, police brutality, environmental issues. These dancers have made a half dozen short films together that tackle current events through their art. John Boogs told us that a lot of dancers can move. He and Buck want to do something bigger than themselves. They want to take on social issues as great pop artists do.
I mean, if you look at any of the greats, like Michael Jackson, he had like Man in the Mirror, he had They Don't Care About Us. James Brown, he had Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. Nina Simone, Marvin Gaye with What's Going On. I mean, there's you know, just so many artists who are revolutionary and help change music or change art. They always use their platform to reflect on what was going on in society or going on in the world at the time. So I just feel like if we have a platform to inspire or a platform to say something, we might as well touch on some things and hopefully do our part and hopefully creating some positive energy in the world.
And the films we have that you've seen so far are films that really hit home for us as well. We didn't just do them because we felt like it was necessary because this is going on. We did it because I got friends. My friend John My friend John Chicago was shot by police when we did the Color of Reality. And we both been through situations where we had stuff happen and we, you know, to be able to collaborate with, to put our minds together and put that out on film to where, like, we can actually push our personal, you know, just let people know how we personally feel and let our vulnerable side out. People can really connect to it because a lot of people really feel, you never know how people feel on the outside. You know, we all have this shell that we wear. And then, you know, you never know what's going on in the inside. But when we do these performances and this emotion comes out, then, you know, we're all in one frequency, so.
That last voice belongs to Lil Buck, and we're tweeting out a link to that video, The Color of Reality. It deals with police brutality toward young black men. Lil Buck says he and Boogs want to perform for all kinds of audiences, but he's most focused on how his art affects kids. He used to be one.
All I did was watch TV and dance and want to wear these shoes that these rappers and whoever were wearing. So I said, if I get in this space, infiltrate this space, and get to, like, really connect with kids through these mediums that they see all the time, that's why I wanted to do commercials. That's why I wanted to do all these things. I get to actually have this reach to the youth back. They get to see me on TV, that person that lived in the same neighborhood they did 5 years ago, and be like, dang, he wearing those shoes that this rapper was wearing. He's only dancing and this and that. And they start paying attention then. And then once they start paying attention, they start really seeing the messages that we have in our movements and what we do. So it's like a little trickle. It's like a little domino effect, and it's like a little reel in. You know, I'm reeling them in through what they love and what we loved growing up as far as, like, fashion. And
that's such a great way to look at it, because different, you know, in these inner cities, a lot of kids are, I mean, let's be honest, they're only stimulated in a couple ways. They love athletics, or they want to be a rapper or musician or some entertainer, or they might want to be gangsters. You know what I mean? You know, let's be honest. Like, sometimes in these rough neighborhoods, there's not many options. So if we can be an outlet and use things that stimulate them to kind of draw them over to us, because, and then they see, oh, they do it this way, and they're using dance to talk about this, and they're not just...
I don't always have to dance to gangster rap music. Yeah, I can dance to this,
I can
do that with all comfortability, though, because I remember back when I was learning ballet, I was the only man who was in there, like, okay, I mean, the only straight guy from the streets, you know, that I was like, I don't mind taking ballet. I mean, I ain't wearing no tights, but I'll do it. And that was my thing. Like, and they let me, you know, take ballet in sweats until eventually I felt comfortable wearing tights. When I go back home now to see how many young kids from my neighborhoods, like, actually getting into what they always wanted to do. It's a lot of people who always wanted to be free like that, or wanted to step outside of a comfort zone, or even feel comfortable being in their comfort zone around people. You know, a lot of people didn't do that because they felt that they were going to be talked about, or just pressured into, you know, feeling people making them feel bad about being themselves. So, like, I chose to do that, and I chose to be like, hey, man, look, you guys saw the path that I took. You can create your own path. You don't have to take the exact path, but it doesn't necessarily have to be this either. Yeah. What's going on and what's happening in the streets. You can create your own path like I did. If you don't want to do ballet, fine, but you don't have to do that, you know, to feel like you're someone.
Dancers Lil Buck and John Boogs, they were just at the Edmonds Center for the Arts last week, premiering a new live performance called Love Heals All Wounds. They talked with KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman, and you can see some of their videos at our website. Just go to KUOW.org. KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. I'm Bill Radke. Finally today, a story about your environment and a sea lion named Biff. Northwest Wildlife Managers have lethally removed 175 California sea lions from the Columbia River. Lethally removed. That means they were killed for eating too much salmon at Bonneville Dam. They've got fish ladders there. Fish ladders are a sea lion buffet. But not all the buffet-eating sea lions got that death penalty. Some of them were sent to zoos and aquariums instead. EarthFix reporter Cassandra Profita visited a sea lion named Biff, who's alive, in Chicago's Shedd Aquarium.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Shedd Aquarium, and welcome to the Pacific Northwest.
The Shedd Aquarium sits on the end of a pier in Lake Michigan. It's surrounded by water with a sweet view of the Chicago skyline wrapped around the lakeshore. But they've done a lot to make visitors from the Pacific Northwest feel at home.
That's right. You're no longer in Chicago. When you came down that staircase, you left Chicago. Now you're somewhere else, more around Northern California, Oregon, Washington State.
Walking into the sea lion area, I'm greeted by a waterfall, huge fake conifers, and a host named Herb with a microphone.
Check it out. You can see rock formations. You can even see sitka spruce trees in western hemlocks.
I doubt they're fooling Biff. He's a sea lion who's lived here since he was removed from the Columbia River in 2009. But today, Biff isn't out here on the exhibit floor.
So I step in here.
I rinse my shoes in a foot bath, and trainer Eric Daniel shows me into a back room where Biff does his training sessions.
Yeah. This is Biff. Yeah, this is Biff. You can step in here a little closer.
Biff is lying on the floor behind metal bars, and he has his own little playground with two hot tub-sized pools and a tunnel made out of what looks like two bent-over bike racks. His huge brown eyes are looking right at me, with just a few feet between us.
Oh, he's definitely checking us out, huh?
Yeah, he prefers to be on this end of things because he can see us and see what we're doing.
He still has his brand, C700, etched into his back. Those are the markings managers use to identify and remove him from Bonneville Dam. The trainer blows a little whistle, and Biff springs into action. He jumps in and out of the pool.
Swim. Good.
He holds up one flipper, then the other.
Wave.
He even flips his tail up over his head in a sea lion headstand.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, very. This shows a lot of trust that we've developed between one another.
After each correct move, his trainer tosses him little fish.
Spin.
They're about 6 inches long.
Good.
Nothing compared to the 20-pound salmon he used to eat on the Columbia. He's lost more than 250 pounds on the aquarium diet. That's about a quarter of his original body weight. But he's still pretty darn big.
So what we can do is call him back up, and if you want to do some tactile, you can.
Just when I thought I'd seen it all, they let me pet him. They call it tactile.
Okay.
You don't have to.
No, I think that sounds really fun. Show me what to do.
The trainer calls him over, and he sits up next to the bars.
And you're just going to go ahead and you can just give him a little rub on the chest right there.
His fur is cold and wet, and it's strange, petting a wild animal, knowing he would be dead if he weren't here, behind bars.
Good. Swim!
Daniel, his trainer, says Biff adapted quickly to life in the aquarium, and seems to be doing well.
He's very smart, very sharp animal. Very food motivated, so All the things that got him in trouble in the first place.
Dr. Bill Van Bon is the vice president of animal health at the aquarium. He says having Biff around helps teach people about the conflict that brought him here.
We're really faced with a conservation conundrum. As these animals do really well in the wild, as their populations rebound, they tend to want to be in the similar places that people want to be.
He says aquariums probably aren't the solution to sea lions eating salmon at dams.
You know, the numbers of animals that are potentially needing homes far exceeds our capacity as a community.
And those numbers are likely to grow. Wildlife managers recently proposed killing sea lions at a second location, Willamette Falls. It's another bottleneck for fish upstream from Portland. Sea lions are now eating more than a quarter of the steelhead run there, and biologists say if they don't kill the sea lions, the fish may very well go extinct. I'm Cassandra Profita reporting.
And that's all for the record today from KUOW. Thank you, Biff, for letting us tweet out you and your big brown eyes at KUOW. And thanks to the team that puts this show together. Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano. We got help today from Casey Martin and Bree Ripley. Come back tomorrow. I'm going to be talking with Seattle writer Ijeoma Oluo. She's got a new book out. It's called So You Want to Talk About Race. And you know what? I do. And we will. With Ijeoma Oluo tomorrow at noon. Thank you for listening.